study through the whole Bible. You'll find your notes in your program. The message today titled United We Stand, Divided We Fall. My microphone sounds a little hot. Now that saying came up first like 500 years before Christ. They've been saying that. United we stand, divided we fall. And it's great to see how God is uniting us and adding people to our number. I forgot to mention earlier, so we'll do it at the luncheon, but we're all receiving today into membership Tammy Kassler and Rick Wellman. So we thank God for bringing them on board, and I'll give you your certificates and pray for you at the luncheon if you're there. United we stand, divided we fall. And like I said, there's so much going into these messages. We're trying to look at the whole Bible through the year and get the big picture of it. You know, especially when you're starting out, there is a lot of difficult things to understand, especially the whole picture. And speaking over so much on one Sunday is challenging. So therefore, I always recommend, take the notes home. Use it if you don't have your own devotional, your own way of studying the Bible. Take it home, read, go deeper into the verses that are shared. You can watch this again at home on YouTube and get the bigger picture of these books. So, and we are going to be tying into it the resurrection as we are just two or three Sundays from Easter. And today, you'll notice again that we're looking at the books that are in red, 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles. And throughout the books we've already looked at, we see that God is communicating to us constantly. It's throughout the entire Bible. In Revelation, the last book of the Bible, it ends with a continual reminder, he who has ears to hear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. So it's God is always speaking. The Genesis begins with, and God said, let there be, and there was. Day after day of creation, God speaks. And then through that, you know, sin separates us, and that's why we have the Bible, because God can no longer just speak to us, man to man, or man to woman, or God to woman. So he has the Bible, written through certain people that most of the time we call them prophets, but not all were necessarily prophets, but God would speak to them, and they would write down his word, so that we would know him, so that when Jesus showed up on the planet, we would know who he was. Otherwise, there'd be no context. He'd show up 2,000 years ago and say, I'm the Son of God. And we'd be like, the Son of who? But the Bible gives us the context. When he draws Israel out of Egypt, he gives them the law of God. And all of Numbers and Deuteronomy is telling us again how God has spoken his commands, his word, so we would know how to approach him, how we could be back with him, and then reminding us again and again and again to obey, to keep, to guard, to wrap his word around our minds and our hearts, to be careful, to always stay in line with him. And then we saw in the book of Judges, Israel kept falling away. And then a few weeks ago, we got into Samuel, and we saw how now they had a king. And the first king of Israel was named Saul, and he was not a man after God's own heart. He was a king like all the other nations, and he always put himself first. But then God said, I'm going to raise up a king after my own heart, right? A guy who is seeking me, and that king's name was David. And we saw that David overall lived a life of seeking God's presence with one major, major mistake and flaw that ended in adultery and murder. But God forgave him. The consequences of his sin remained, and we saw that last week. His family was devastated. You know, the Bible talks about how the sins of the fathers or sins of the parents, you know, they're generational. Not that the kids are being punished for their parents' sin, but when we make huge mistakes, it affects the people around us. It devastates them. And that's what we saw last week. Well, now we get into 1 and 2 Kings. And in the blue Bibles, if you're using the blue Bible, it's starting in page 263 is where we'll be starting, 1 Kings chapter 3. Because David unites Israel. So when it says there, the United Kingdom unites Israel. This is not England, this is Israel. So the time of the period where there was the United Kingdom. And things were great. David is now old. As we get into 1 Kings, it's the first two chapters are basically David's dying, and he passes, and he has named his son Solomon to be the next king of Israel. And in chapter 3, Solomon starts off really well. He's about 20 years old. And in chapter 3, if you know about Solomon, you've probably heard, you know, that he was the wisest man on earth. Those of you that, the younger guys in here that maybe don't know a lot about Solomon, but you've probably watched the Shazam movies, and Shazam, his superhero, one of the first things that is said to him when he receives his powers is, you will have the wisdom of Solomon. Because Solomon was known as one of the most wisest men, or the most wisest on the earth. And this is why in chapter 3 he becomes king, and God appears to him in a vision, in a dream. And as he is speaking to him in verse 7, now the Lord, so chapter 3, verse 7, now the Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. But I am only a little child. Again, he's around 20, we believe, and do not know how to carry out my duties. My servant is here among the people you have chosen, or your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So God has asked him in the verses before that, God tells Solomon, ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you. So here's what he asks for. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong, for who is able to govern so great, or this great people of yours? So then God goes on and tells Solomon, I'll give you what you asked for. And God is so impressed that he didn't ask for wealth, for power, for the destruction of his enemies. So God says, since you didn't ask for those things, but you asked wisely, you asked to be able to lead my people well, I'm going to give you discernment so you can lead them, and you will be so wise, there'll be no one that can be compared to you. But because you asked for that and not for the other things, I'm going to give you that too. I'm going to give you wealth, and I'm going to give you you'll have peace, and there'll be peace in the land, and you'll rule, and it happens. In the next few chapters, it talks about his wisdom and how people would come from afar, and they would bring tribute. And people would come to bring him tribute, but they would come just to hear his wisdom. One of them was called the Queen of Sheba, and she comes with a caravan of gold and spices and clothes and robes and just all of these gifts for the great King Solomon. And even Pharaoh would honor Solomon and Israel at this time. It's kind of the golden age of Israel. And after she comes and approaches the Queen of Sheba, talks with him, and she peppers him with questions. She just throws all of these things that she had wondered about and couldn't understand, and he answers all of them. And she says, because normally when somebody builds up something, like that's why if there's a movie I might want to go see, I don't like people to talk it up too much. Or a restaurant I might want to go try out, because if they talk it up too much, my expectations are so high that normally I'm disappointed because they set the bar so high, right? So Solomon's fame is running throughout the known world at this time, and she, as many would come, and they would say, it's so much more than I expected. The things that were told to me about your wisdom don't even compare. It's greater than I expected. It says that the amount of gold that he received annually was 25 tons plus other stuff, other gold that came in from other sources. 25 tons, that's 50,000 pounds of gold. And then it says, plus silver. Everything was made of gold in the palace. It says they hardly made anything of silver, because silver was considered really of no value because he had so much gold. I mean, so much wealth and wisdom. He built a palace. It took him 13 years to build his palace. This must have been an amazing palace. And it talks about how everything was inlaid with gold. It talks about his throne that had six steps, and it had lions on each side of the steps. And it says there was nothing like it anywhere else. And he built a hall get this, is called the Hall of Justice. And I thought, you know, does that make Solomon the first superhero, the first, you know, for DC Comics, you know, the Hall of Justice, the Justice League? That's what I grew up watching. And I read, I was like, wow, so many things have been taken from the Bible and used in popular culture, and popular culture has no idea. The Hall of Justice, where he would judge and people would see the kind of wisdom that he had. So in everything's great, but then things go south. So all of this wisdom, if you're looking, you know, just let's flip over chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, Solomon builds the temple. Took him 7 years to build the temple. That's, I kind of wonder about that too. 13 years to build his palaces, 7 years to build the temple. And he builds it. David wanted to, but he didn't get to. Solomon builds it. And in chapter 7, it talks about his palace, and then the temple again, and then in chapter 7 and 8, chapter 8, the ark is brought into the temple, and then in chapter 8, Solomon prays to dedicate the temple. And he says, you know, Lord, he prays, whenever people come here and pray out to you, and whenever we sin, because everybody sins, whenever we forget, whenever we do these things that are wrong, we come to this place, this temple, and cry out to you, will you hear from heaven and answer? And he says these words, even if we stray from you so much that you hand us over to our enemies and we're taken captive to a foreign land. In that foreign land, if we look towards Israel and pray towards this holy place, will you hear from heaven and give us mercy in the eyes of those that have taken us captive and defeated us and allow us to return? All of that happened. As we'll go in through the Bible, we'll see that that happens. They get taken into Babylon and they pray. And they pray facing Daniel in particular, facing Jerusalem. And God puts mercy on part of Cyrus, the king of the Persians, and he lets them go back. God honored that prayer. And God says in Chronicles, it doesn't say it here, the exact words, but God says, yes, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, I will hear from heaven, forgive their sins, and heal their land. So that's all good, right? Everything's great. It's like, man, this is awesome. Until we get to chapter 11. And in chapter 11, things go terribly bad. It says that King Solomon, however, loved many foreign wives. Now, because he was so powerful and so great, the first one it mentions is Pharaoh. Pharaoh offered his daughter to Solomon as a bride, a princess. And therefore, there would be peace. He's not going to go to war against his daughter, who's a princess or a queen of Israel. But he was so powerful and wealthy that many other kings did the same thing. So it says in verse 1, Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and the Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. So Solomon grew old, and his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. And he followed Ashtoreth, and the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place to Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all the foreign wives and burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. And then talks about how God's anger burned against him. And then look down in verse 13. So God says he's going to take the kingdom away from him. And look at verse 12. Let's start in verse 12. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do this during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So what's the big deal here? Is he just, you know, did he just stop going to church, right? Many of us have children that have been brought up in church and aren't going to church anymore. They haven't necessarily turned their backs on God, but they're not really following after God with all their heart. That's not what it's talking about here. Again, remember, he's the king. He's the leader of God's people. And just because you're wisdom doesn't mean you can't be dumb or do dumb things. He's not dumb. He's smart. He's wise. But it doesn't mean you're always going to act wisely. And Solomon doesn't act wisely. He built the temple, yet he's going to the high places. Whenever it talks about high places, it's talking about places where they go up on hills or tops of mountains and they build altars to false gods. And the Ashereth and Asherah is a female goddess, kind of like Aphrodite in the Greek mythology. So in the practice of worship of Ashereth and Asherah, you would practice prostitution or religious type of, there would be temple prostitutes, because if you're worshiping the goddess of fertility, then that would be part of what she would consider worship. And he was offering to them, but not only to them, to Molech and Chemosh. And you notice when it says the detestable gods of Molech and Chemosh, because in worship to those deities, you would give human sacrifices, even their own children. And it says, right, the detestable god of the Moabites. Well, in 2 Kings, Israel is fighting against Moab. And it says this: when the king of Moab saw that the battle had gone against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through to the kingdom of Edom, but they failed. Then he took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him as king, and offered him as a sacrifice on the city wall. And the fury against Israel was great. They withdrew and returned to their own land. So here we see this man sacrificing, a Moabite sacrificing his son. And Solomon was setting up altars and offering sacrifices to these gods. So it matters who you marry. It matters who you marry. And that's why God was saying, one wife is more than a handful, right, guys? Right. I mean, he could afford it. He was the richest man on the planet. But with that many wives, it was too hard for him to not be led astray. So even though you can be smart, doesn't mean you can't make mistakes and be dumb. And it matters who you marry, because that's the person that you're going to be closest to in your life. And then we're talking about united we stand, divided we fall. But it's united to God we stand, divided from God we fall. And that's what God is continuing to say. He said to Solomon, if you stay with me, if you obey me, I will bless you. But if you depart from my word, if you depart from me, if you follow those other nations' ways, then you will fall. And he tells him, now I'm going to take the kingdom. I'm going to divide the kingdom. You're going to lose most of the kingdom. There's 12 tribes. He's only going to leave him one. Well, the next guy, so then we go into the divided kingdom. And here's what happens in the divided kingdom. As you get to chapter 12, Solomon has just died, and now his son, Rehoboam, becomes king. So the apple fell very far from the tree when it comes to wisdom, because Rehoboam wasn't all that smart. Rehoboam becomes king, and now Solomon had been king, and he had been, you know, everybody did what Solomon said, but he built all of these palaces and the temple, and for 20 years they've been working and working and working. And the fleet of ships, and he had 30,000 people working on some of these projects. Not even including the supervisors and the foremen, it says. So when Solomon dies, the people come to his son and look. They say, listen, for the last like 20 years, your dad's been working us hard. I mean, I'm sure they probably got paid for it, but maybe this is kind of like the first union that's happening here. Like, you know what, we got to band together, you know. Now let's ask him to not work us so hard. Give us a little bit of a break. And Rehoboam says, you know, give me a few days. I'll think about it, and then you guys come back, and I'll give you my answer. So they go away. Rehoboam consults his father's counselors. So he's just become king. His father's advisors are still around. So he calls in his father's advisors. So these were older men who had advised the wisest man on the planet. So you would think, you know, Solomon wasn't going to have idiots around him. So these had to be pretty smart men as well. They tell Rehoboam, hey, listen up. They got a legitimate argument. I mean, your dad has worked them really hard. You're the new king. If you lighten their load a little bit, they will respect you. They will honor you, and you'll have their loyalty. They're okay. They leave. And he says, you know, maybe he's hanging out with the fellas. They're playing racquetball. Who knows what they're doing there. He's talking to the guys. And he's like, hey, these guys came. You know, they said, give them a break. My dad's advisors thought I should give them a break. What do you guys think? So now these are his buddies. And his people, his age, they tell him, you know what you ought to do? You ought to tell them, you think my dad worked you guys. My dad might have, this kind of paraphrasing, my dad might have laid a finger on you, but I'm going to put my whole hand on you. And he follows their advice. So they come in and he tells them that, I'm going to work you guys even harder. Who do you guys think you are? I'm the king. And they're like, you know what? Forget you. You're not our king. What do we have to do with the house of Solomon, the house of David? And they go back up to Israel, the northern part, and that's what you see on the other side of the divided kingdom. So it matters who you listen to. It matters who you listen to. And we've all heard the phrase, right? Hey, listen up. Speakers do this all the time. Parents, teachers do this all the time. About to say something important, you're like, okay, all right, listen up, right? You want to make sure you have their attention. But we also need to listen upwards. Listen up, kind of a play on words. Not just listen up, like, hey, let me pay attention. Listen upwards. The older people get, the more experience they have, right? Those of us in here, the grayer our heads are. That's why the Bible talks about how those with gray hair speak with wisdom. It's not that they became wise. It's just saying those with life experience. That's why Solomon prayed for wisdom. He was so young. He's like, I don't have the experience or the wisdom yet to be king because I'm so young. That's why, especially as teenagers and even young 20-year-olds, when you need advice, it's always good to listen up to people that have walked in those shoes, who have been there before, people who have had jobs and gotten fired and then gotten promoted and had conflict and resolved them, who have been married and lasted or been married and got divorced and know what that's like. Talk to people who have been there and walked there already. Listen up. And by upwards, I'm meaning upwards in age. That's why, you know, you don't see very many 40-year-old gangsters or gang members, right? Most of those guys at that age are telling the younger guys, don't do it. Get off the street, right? When they were at that age, they wanted to be on the street. But at some point, they normally start saying, all right, I don't want to keep doing this my whole life. So listen upwards. So if you're looking at the map there, and we're trying to see just so you know, we're going through the big picture of what God is doing. And I'm going to bring it in more next week. But this whole story of God saying, I'm going to promise that the Messiah, the Son, the Savior, will come through David. That's why he says, I'm going to leave you one tribe, because I've promised that David will always have somebody sitting on the throne. So he's got to leave him somebody. So the nation gets divided. And then 1st and 2nd Kings, the difference between that and Chronicles is that 1st and 2nd Kings is talking about the northern and the southern, Israel and the southern tribe of Judah, where Chronicles is only dealing with the tribe of Judah. But of each, it's talking about their disobedience, but Chronicles is focusing a little bit more on the obedience, the hope that God is still going to fulfill his promise. Chronicles focus more on the priest. We'll look at Chronicles a little bit more next week. And Kings focuses more on the prophets. So here's what I want us to see as we go into, we're going to fly through a couple of kings here, and then we're going to get into the prophet and draw some lessons from the prophet Elijah and Elisha. Israel to the north had 20 kings over about 380 years. And to the south, Judah had 20 kings over 380 years. Israel gets so bad that God allows the Assyrians to take them captive, and Israel is no more. The nation, the tribes, they're gone. But Judah remains a little bit longer. They each had 20 kings over this period of time. All of Israel's kings to the north, all of them were bad. All of them were. Israel, of the 20 kings they had, 8 were considered good. And this is what you see, this phrase that gets repeated when it comes to the bad kings. It says something like this. The bad kings did evil in the eyes of the Lord as his father, or this king did evil in the eyes of the Lord as his father and caused Israel to sin. I want you to turn with me to chapter 15 to see one of these. In chapter 15, verse 3, it says about this new king, the son of Jeroboam becomes king. He committed all the sins his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord, his God, as the heart of David, his forefather. Nevertheless, for David's sake, okay, so that's Abijah. Then you go on to verse 9, and it talks about King Asa of Judah. And look at verse 11. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land and got rid of the idols his ancestors had made. So with the bad kings, it says this. They did evil in the eyes of the Lord as their father had done and caused Israel to sin. With the good kings, it says something like this. They did what was right in the eyes of the Lord as his father David and either removed or rebuilt or expelled, removed all the high places and rebuilt the temple and restored. It always follows up with something like that. So let's fast forward here, chapter 15, 16, 17. And in chapter 16, verse 29, this is the king we're going to focus on, King Ahab. Chapter 16, verse 29. So let me tell you the story here that's going on with King Ahab. Let's start here. It says in verse 30, Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord. And you know how it says eyes? Because remember, Judges said that there was no king in Israel, and all the people did what was right in their own eyes. And here it keeps emphasizing, right? It's the eyes of the Lord that matter. It's doing what's right in his eyes, not in our eyes, not in our friends' eyes, not in society's eyes, not in the politics' eyes, not in the woke culture eyes or whatever it is. It's what does God say? His eyes are the ones that matter. And he did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ithbal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal and built in Samaria, and Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did the kings of Israel before him. So in the very next chapter, we're introduced to a prophet named Elijah, one of the most important prophets in the Bible. Elijah is said to return before Jesus. John the Baptist, who was preaching before Jesus, is said to have come in the power and spirit of Elijah. And in Revelation, we believe Elijah returns before Jesus comes in the last days. One reason is because Elijah didn't die naturally. God took him up into heaven. So we're expecting him to come back before Jesus returns. So Elijah is incredibly important. And Ahab and Jezebel, his wife, they're not only practicing this false religion, they're actually killing all the prophets that they can find. So much that this guy named Obadiah, who works for the king, but is secretly a believer in God, he's hidden 100 prophets, 50 in one cave and 50 in another cave. He's hiding them from Jezebel, the king's wife, because if she finds them, she will kill them. Right? That's what Ahab and Jezebel are doing. So God sends Elijah, and God tells Elijah to pray for there to be no rain. Now, you think God could just say it's not going to rain, but he works through his prophets, his preachers, and Elijah says, okay, he declares, and he prays and says, no rain until he prays for it to rain. 3.5 years go by. So 3.5 years, no rain, drought, everything's drying up, there's no food. God is providing miraculously for Elijah during these 3.5 years. But during these 3.5 years, Elijah has to be hiding because Ahab, if he finds him, will kill him. Well, in chapter 18 is where Elijah appears to Obadiah. And he tells Obadiah, go and get Ahab because the time has come. So it's been 3.5 years. I wish I could tell more of the story, but he goes and gets Ahab. Ahab comes. And in chapter 18, verse 16, Elijah says, you have been killing the prophets. He feels like he's the only one left, but we already know there's at least 100. And he says, go get the 400 prophets of Asherah that you have and the 450 prophets of Baal and call them all here to Mount Carmel. Call them here. So Ahab went, verse 20, gets all of them. And verse 21, Elijah went before the people and said, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. Like, make up your minds. And Elijah said to them, okay, so this is what he says. He says, all you 450 prophets of Baal, build an altar and put a sacrifice on it. And then I'll do the same. And whichever God answers by fire, he is the Lord. And all the people said, sounds good to us. Let's do it. So they start and they build an altar. And in verse 25, so Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one of the bulls and prepare it. Since there are so many of you, call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire. So they took the bull given to them and prepared it. They called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, I love this part. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Hey, shout. What's that song? Shout a little louder. Hey, shout a little louder. Shout a little louder, he said. Surely he is a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought or busy or traveling. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. I think some say that he might have also said when he's busy that he might have also said maybe he's relieving himself. Maybe he's in the bathroom. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears as was their custom until blood flowed midday past. And they continued in their frantic prophesying until the time of the evening sacrifice, but there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. So this is not just, you know, in smart, guided prayer. They're just frantically chanting, ecstatically chanting. And then Elijah says, okay, it's my turn. Come here. And he has them prepare an altar as the Lord had commanded. Right? So he prepared the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, prepared it, the bull that was going to be sacrificed or offered. Then he says, arrange the wood. They arrange the wood. Then he digs out a ditch around the sacrifice. And then he says, he arranged the wood, verse 33, he arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces. Then he said to them, fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and the wood. They did it. And he says, do it again. And they did it. He says, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. So much that the water went all the way down through the wood and filled up the little ditch that he had dug around the altar. And then he prays. At the time of the sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so that these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. It's interesting that he's, you know, the whole motive, the reason God is working is to turn their hearts back to him. Then the fire of the Lord fell, burned up everything, the sacrifice, the wood, everything. And God had a great victory, and then Elijah commanded the people to go and capture and kill the prophets of Baal that had been killing the prophets of God. All right, well, then this goes on, and then Elijah goes and he prays for rain. And he goes and tells Ahab, get ready, because the storm is coming, the rain is coming. And now let's go to chapter 19. So this is a great victory. I mean, this fire has just come down from heaven. It's been an amazing, all day long, he's been taunting them, and now God answers powerfully, and there's the revival happening. And then in chapter 19, Ahab goes and tells Jezebel everything. So apparently, Jezebel wasn't there. He goes and tells his wife everything Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them. So she threatens him. And this is the part that's just kind of confusing. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. It's like, wait a minute, dude, you just called fire down from heaven. Now you're running. You're afraid and running for your life. What's going on here? So then he goes and he prays, you know, I've had enough, Lord. I'm not better than my ancestors. And then he lay down under the bush and fell asleep. Right? So he's basically saying that's it. He says right before that, he prayed that he might die. I'm done. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I've had enough. At once an angel, so he falls asleep, and then an angel comes and touches him and says, get up and eat. He looked around him, and I don't know if it was angel food cake, I guess, and he eats. He looked around, and there was by his head some bread baked over hot coal. So he eats it. He drinks water from the jar, and he ate and he drank, and he lay down again and went to sleep. Then the angel of the Lord woke him up again. Get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. And there he went. Then God appears to him, and he says this twice. This is what he tells God. I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They have torn down your altars and put your prophets to death with the sword, and I am the only one left. And now they are trying to kill me too. So God goes and he speaks to him. He reveals himself to him in this quiet whisper. In verse 14, Elijah repeats the same thing. You know, that all the people have turned away. I'm the only one left. And then God tells him, go anoint this man to be the king and the next priest, and go anoint Elisha to be the next prophet after you. And then he says in verse 18, but yet I reserve 7,000 in Israel. In other words, you're not the only one. And then let's go on to so he calls Elisha, and in verse 21, Elisha says to him, can I go back and say goodbye to my family? So Elisha left him, went back. He took his yoke of oxen. Now it says that he was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. So he had a lot of land. His family was wealthy, and he was leading one of the yokes. So that's two oxen. So that's 24 oxen. That's a lot. So it's a wealthy family. He takes the oxen and slaughtered them and burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elijah. All right, so I want to bring out, I know your notes say 4 points. I'm going to bring out five. There's so many I could have, but I'm just going to try to keep it to five. And the first one is what we learned from this. God works to turn our hearts back to him. Right? Individually and nationally. The people were, Elijah was saying, they've left you. And I identify with that because I look at our world and I look at our nation and I think, you know, the worlds they're abandoning you. They're going away from God. They're taking God out of everything. Our nation has rejected God. It seems that way. It seems like it's getting worse and worse and worse. And that's kind of how I think Elijah feels. And maybe some of our prayers are, and we have to realize that, number one, God, like he tells Elisha, hey, it might look bad, but I've got some real followers out there. Don't worry about the church. But also, everything that I am doing it to turn their hearts back to me. Not to punish them, not to judge, but to bring them back to me. And he's doing that in each of our lives today, too. Not just as America, but where are you today? And where are you, you know, whatever God is doing, whatever's happening around your life, understand this, that everything happens so that our hearts will be drawn to him. The second thing is, watch out for the low after the high. He had a mountaintop experience, and he gets threatened, and he runs and says, I'm done, God. I just want to die. I'm finished. You know, sometimes we're so excited about something. Something good has happened, and somebody else with just one negative comment can totally just discourage us, and we go from being so excited to just so frustrated and depressed. Another thing I also, so like there's Daniel. Daniel was an amazing prophet, and he had this vision that God had given him. And after the vision, after he wakes up from the vision, this is what Daniel says. I was worn out. I lay exhausted for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was appalled at the vision. It was beyond understanding. He was exhausted from an from a spiritual encounter. Remember, it's been 3.5 years for Elijah. So you have to be careful. You have to be ready for that. And you have to also, like, we're talking a lot about mental health today. And I wonder if maybe Elijah might have struggled with depression. Some of the conditions that we know of today existed back then. They're not just brand new. They might be more prevalent now, but maybe he struggled with that. And he goes from this high to this incredible low. And that also reminds me or encourages me, because if we're sitting here, we're thinking, you know, I struggle with anxiety, or I struggle with depression, or I have these low moments. So did Elijah. And God still used him in an incredibly powerful way. None of that disqualifies us. It only gives God more glory when he uses us. The next thing is, he tells that the journey is too hard to do it in your own strength. I love the way God ministers to Elijah. He's worn out. He's like, I'm tired. I'm done. He lets him sleep, but then he wakes him up to feed him and says, it's too much for you, Elijah. The journey is too hard. Here, eat some heavenly food. And then he eats again. It says, in the strength of that food, he was able to run 40 days and 40 nights. And it reminds me of what Jesus said to the disciples. He said to them, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to rest or to eat. So Jesus says to his disciples, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. And so even Jesus understands we can't go 24/7. You need to come back. And he says, come back to a quiet place with me. See that? That's the important part. Come back with me. And Jesus says this in John 15. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Two verses later, he says, if you remain in me and my words, remember we're talking so much about the word, knowing the word, obeying the word, keeping the word. If it remains in you, then ask whatever you wish and it will be done. So the journey is too much for us to go in our own strength. We have to, and we're talking about the journey of life, whatever journey you're in, whatever, we can do a lot without God. We can get a lot accomplished. But we can do so much more with him. Like infinitely more, and not burn out. And the next lesson is the journey is too hard to go it alone. Too hard to go it alone. He goes and he gets Elisha. So Elijah's been by himself, but now he's got Elisha. He's got somebody to walk with him. We need God, but God has created us to need each other and to walk through this life. And we're not talking about just a spouse. I mean, we know that, you know, the closest person to me in my life is my wife in terms of knowing me intimately and seeing the good, the bad, and the ugly, but I need friends. I need godly friends. I need men who can walk through this life together with me. Amen. And lesson number 5. Make your past an altar, not an anchor. So Elijah comes up to him. He's got a life. He's got land. He's got oxen. He's doing good. And Elijah comes up and says, I want you to follow me. And Elisha says, okay, well, let me say goodbye to my parents. And what he does is he takes the oxen, the wood, the yoke, breaks it, burns it, makes it a fire, and kills it. In other words, he's saying, you know, like that past, that was his presence. You know, an anchor is what kind of holds us back, like this big board. And instead of saying, you know what, I don't want to let it go. He could have said, no, my land and my family and my wealth, and it's going to hold me back. It's going to keep me where I am. I'm not going to follow God because I don't want to let this go. I'm not going to experience all that God has for me because I don't want to let this go. And some of us are still walking through lives, not letting things go. And God is saying, I want you to run with me, but you got to let that go. That pain, you got to let it go. That vision, that dream of yours, you got to let it go. That whatever it is, you got to let it go. And then what he does is he takes that, and instead of letting it become an anchor to hold him back, he makes it an altar. And he sets it on fire. And some of us need spiritually to set our past on fire and offer it to God as a sacrifice. So, will you pray with me? Father, we thank you so much for your word. And I want to pray, Lord, as we go through this message today, just following up, covering so many things. Everyone could have been its own sermon in a way. But for those here who are, you are calling them back. That's why they're here. That's why they started coming. That's why they started looking. If that's you, I want you to know that Jesus says, no one can come to me unless the Father draws them. If you woke up one day and said, let's go to church, it wasn't because you decided you wanted to find God. It's because God was putting it in your heart. God was nudging. God was saying, I'm drawing you back, your heart. And maybe it's not back. Maybe it's for the very first time. And just say, I come to you, Jesus. I say yes. Yes, Lord. I give you my life. I give you my heart. Put it in your hands. I put it on the altar. And maybe some of you are weary. You're tired. You're, oh man, it's just, you're like Elijah. You're saying, I just don't know if I can go another day. I want to ask, how connected are you to Jesus? How connected are you to are you eating spiritually, nurturing your body, your soul daily to have the strength to go through this day? And make that a priority. And connect yourself to whoever you need to connect yourself with to help you grow and be accountable in that prayer time. In that continual being connected to God and to others. And if there's anything in your past that when that was the one that just like that lights went off, bells went off in your heart, in your mind, and you're like, yeah, that's something I've got stuff I need to let go of. I need to set it on fire. Then do that spiritually today. Even come up. The altar is always open. You can come up and either stand up front or kneel down if you want to. But respond however God has spoken to you this morning. He's here. He is speaking. He is working. I just want to invite us to stand that way. If anybody does want to make their way out and come up front, you can go ahead and do that already. Just makes it a little bit easier. And you just come and respond. Whether you're giving your heart back to God or giving your tiredness and weariness and asking for Him to fill you, not just today, but to draw close to Him every day. Or whether you need to give your past to God. Just take a moment and pray. Everyone else, we're just praying right now. And you can pray where you are. Exalt Him, worship Him. No matter how far Israel got from God, He kept working to bring their hearts back. Thank you, Father. Hear our prayers, Lord. Hear our prayers, Father. Thank you, Jesus. I want to just remind you that the altar is open. You can come forward, but we're going to close with a song, and you don't need to go back to your seat until God has met you. We're going to close with a song, The Goodness of God. And there's a part in the song, the whole song is good, but there's a part of the song where it talks about the goodness of God is running after us. And it's a beautiful picture of what we're talking about now. We have a God who chases after us so that we can experience His grace and His goodness. And let that sink in this morning. Let that sink in and remove any guilt, any shame, any performance, like I'm not doing as well as I need to. Just know that the goodness of God this morning is running after you. Let's sing together. And again, the altar is open. You feel free to come and